like to capture your minds right now. Take you a little bit higher.
This is Indie Media On Air for the week of August 11, 2008. On today's show, we'll hear a talk by Mozam Beg, a former British detainee at Guantanamo Bay. We'll also learn about a parody of the Vancouver Sun newspaper distributed last year by a group of activists for Palestine. Can West, the newspaper's publisher, was not amused and has gone after the activists in court. We'll also hear a Media Minutes Roundup and the Weekly Radio Spin. I'm Bronwyn Malden with the Los Angeles Independent Media Center. Once a month, Indie Media On Air highlights the work of independent media makers around the globe. Today's work comes to us from Bristol, England, Vancouver, Canada, and here in the U.S., Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, and Madison, Wisconsin.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Last week, the Federal Communications Commission voted to punish Comcast, the nation's largest cable company, for blocking users' access to the open Internet. Media watchdogs Free Press and Public Knowledge had filed a complaint with the agency against the cable giant for blocking legal peer-to-peer content to their users. In a landmark decision, Republican Chairman Kevin Martin and Democratic Commissioners Michael Copps and Jonathan Adelstein approved an enforcement order that would require Comcast to stop blocking and publicly disclose its methods for interfering with Internet traffic.
And would anyone here actually be okay if the post office was opening your mail and deciding that they didn't want to bother delivering it and hiding that fact by sending back to you stamped address unknown return to sender? And unfortunately, this is exactly the practice that Comcast was engaging in with their own subscribers' internet traffic.
That was Chairman Martin, who added that the agency had been very careful to hear from all sides, held two public hearings, and considered thousands of comments sent in by individuals and organizations. Comcast's actions were roundly criticized, Martin said, and not defended by a single other broadband provider.
If we aren't going to stop a company that is looking inside its subscribers' communications, reading the packets that they are sending, blocking the communication when it uses a particular application, regardless of whether there is any congestion on the network at the time, hiding what it is doing by making its consumers think that the problem is their own, and lying about it to the public, what would we stop?
Marvin Amore, general counsel for Free Press, who wrote the complaint that sparked the FCC investigation, said that this is a bellwether case for the future of the Internet.
Millions of concerned Americans knocked on the doors of the FCC demanding that it preserve an open Internet, and the FCC listened. If this decision had happened behind closed doors in Washington, we'd have a closed Internet, not an open one. We have chosen openness to new ideas and choices controlled by all of us, and not closed markets controlled by phone and cable companies.
For more information about the Comcast decision, go to savetheinternet.com.
Far too often, those who are underrepresented by the media are also disconnected from its production and the policies that shape it. People's Production House, a media justice organization based in New York City, was founded to arm up-and-coming journalists with the skills they need to create media, as well as educate them on the policies that impact their work. Deepa Fernandez, co-director of the People's Production House, says that the group emerged to meet the needs of the community media sector that lacked a place to train people as journalists.
We got together and said, well, the only way to do this is to bring new folks in, and to bring folks whose voices are really not represented, and that is youth, that's community organizers who are struggling for community change. So People's Production House works in training new and emerging journalists, but also in educating around media policy issues so that we can really broaden the movement of those who are demanding policy change at a congressional level, and also at the very local level.
People's Production House has several major projects that focus on radio production, community journalism training, and advocacy for universal internet access to bridge the digital divide. People's Production House has taken their training philosophy to the Gulf Coast in response to the absence of media coverage of the devastation after Hurricane Katrina.
Media is really a tool that we talk to each other and we communicate to each other. So it's so important that folks in these devastated regions have ownership of media outlets.
People's Production House works with community organizers to ensure that they have a seat at the table when media policy issues are being discussed. They are working alongside national organizations like Common Cause and the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights to educate the public about the digital television transition because they believe this moment presents an opportunity to expand community media.
We're much more concerned with seeing the public interest obligations on broadcasters increase as their broadcasting capacity increases. So, you know, we're pushing for more opportunities for folks like our own members who are part of community media on the new broadcasting channels.
To learn more about People's Production House, visit their website at peoplesproductionhouse.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
Mozambag is one of nine British Muslims who's been held in extrajudicial detention at Guantanamo Bay. He was released on January 25, 2005, without charge. After his release, he established Cage Prisoners, an organization dedicated to raising awareness of the plight of the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay and other detainees held as part of the so-called War on Terror. Begg spoke recently in Bristol, England. This recording was made and posted online by the Bristol Broadband Cooperative.
Good evening, everyone. I'll give you a distinct greeting. Assalamu alaikum. Please be on time. I know that you've been discussing and watching the film in relation to people that are held on death row in the United States of America. And I've never thought up until Guantanamo Bay much about the whole prison system, particularly that of the United States of America. It's so far removed and it's so not part, or was not so much part of my reality. And then, of course, I was taken to Guantanamo Bay after a whole process, which I'll discuss with you in a minute. But it was the introduction to a particular man that really got my mind thinking as to where I was and how dangerous this whole situation was. I had been contacted by the American Center for Constitutional Rights, who do some amazing work in relation to human rights work in the United States of America. And they had told me that we have arranged a lawyer for you, a lawyer who is different. He's different because he's the only Briton who will be given legal access to detainees in Guantanamo Bay. And that is because he's a dual citizen, because no non-Americans were given access to detainees as legal representatives. So he did come. And he came before this introduction letter. And the introduction letter said that Mr. Clive Stafford Smith, you'll be pleased to know, has been working on death row cases for the past 20 years, so you're in very safe hands. And I thought, oh my God. That's how serious this is. And although it does get a bit of a laugh now, that is really what I thought. This is terrible. This isn't good news. This means that I am literally at the worst possible state that I could be, particularly because at that point, the United States had spoken about the possibility that they will be seeking the death penalty for people found guilty of whatever crimes they had created. Not that they existed, but they created after the fact in Guantanamo, where, of course, the law simply did not at that time and does not today apply if you are a detainee. It does apply if you are an iguana, because they are protected under the Endangered Species Act, any offending soldier or civilian can expect to pay up to $10,000 if they harm one of these lovable creatures. And yet, the whole process that exists in Guantanamo Bay, the military commissions process, which is being described by senior British law lords as a mockery of justice that derives from the jump of the kangaroo, has still been forced through the United States of America as far as the Guantanamo detention sites are concerned, despite the fact that three Supreme Court decisions have been passed, three, in favor of the detainees, in which they are supposedly given the right to challenge their detention through habeas corpus, i.e. that they are told that they what crime that they have committed, so that they are charged with that and then face a court, or they are released. And it's been a veneer, it's been a sort of a decoration in the legal arguments to say that, look, America, after all of this time, has given these people the right of habeas corpus. What a great favor they have done for them. And, of course, in the legal world, there are people who have said what a marvelous victory that is for the legal system, because it shows that America does desire to give these people justice. But you ask any detainee, anyone who's detained, for 7 years without charge or trial. For 7 years, they've never seen their families, never phoned them, never seen them, never been able to communicate with them meaningfully, never seen their children. In some cases, children have been born shortly after the men were abducted and kidnapped from their homes, like myself, and they've never seen their children. In my case, I saw him when I was released, my youngest son, and in the case of many other people, including one who is a resident of Britain, of London, where that child is growing up in this country, having never met his father, and he's nearly 7 years old. And despite all of this, that's why when the recent Supreme Court decision was passed, I had people from the media, CNN and BBC, phoning me to say, isn't it a marvelous thing that this Supreme Court decision has been passed? And I said, what, again, the third time? What difference does it make? Absolutely nothing. Because in practical, tangible terms, the most obvious thing about Guantanamo is that nobody's been convicted of any crime, and particularly in relation to the fact that Guantanamo Bay was set up because we were told that the perpetrators of 9/11, that the terrorists of this world, the most dangerous men on this planet, the worst of the worst, including myself, were there for the protection of the rest of mankind and the rest of society. That's what we were told. And yet not one person has been convicted of any crime, and not one person, not one, has been released as a result of any legal proceedings in Guantanamo Bay. But there is a process that one has to pass through before they ever make it to Guantanamo. And that process has you, at the end of it, looking forward to go to Guantanamo. Looking forward to going to the world's most notorious prison, the world's most infamous prison, the ultimate symbol of injustice that exists in the world. You are looking forward to going there. And the reason why is because you have to pass through a process. Nobody is taken from wherever they're taken from, and people have been taken from countries as wide and diverse as Zambia, Gambia, Indonesia, Azerbaijan, Germany, Jordan, Morocco, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. The processes that one must go through in a lot of these countries that have been forced to choose a side, because we're told by President Bush, you are either with us or against us. There is no in-between. So these countries, poor countries for the most part, that have been cajoled and forced either under threat of military or financial sanctions to cooperate in a process that is euphemistically called extraordinary rendition. And you'd think that we're talking about the rendition of Beethoven's Fifth, but it's not. It's the rendition of human beings. And it has its roots just in the same way that the last time in history that people were taken across the Atlantic in chains by the Americans to the Americas was slavery, and it was of the darker people. And many of those, if you've ever read Roots or seen Roots, you would have known that a great deal of those people were Muslims. And that has a resonance today, because rendition, if you look it up, one of the times it was last used in terms of taking people from one place and removing them to another, was when escaped slaves were rendered back to their masters. And that's the connotation of history that we're talking about, particularly in places like Bristol and Liverpool and others, that of course profited off the slave trade. And that process of extraordinary rendition is a euphemism for something much more sinister, and that is abduction, kidnap, false imprisonment, torture, and in some of the worst cases, death and murder. When I was held in the Bagram detention facility, which is where I was taken to after I'd been kidnapped in front of my wife and children in the middle of the night in Pakistan, which is where I'd evacuated to after having worked in Afghanistan on a project to build a school for girls in Taliban-administered Afghanistan and building a project for wells in the drought-stricken regions of the Northwest. The Bagram facility, which is a place that is a converted Soviet warehouse, where you can still see the inscriptions in Russian from the last time that a superpower occupied the poorest country in Asia. And of course, I was there when the second superpower had occupied this country. And in this place, which you could almost imagine Afghan and Russians walking around together, perhaps the Afghan would have been detained in a similar way. Indeed, I came across Afghan detainees who told me that their fathers had been detained in the very same place that I was now being detained, or their children were being detained by the Americans in their own lands. And in this place, Bagram, it was such that you could hear the footsteps every night and the screams of people being interrogated. The footsteps, of course, were the soldiers walking up, marching up and down, watching us with the lights on 24 hours a day, and the generators that powered them, so there was the hum of the generators that were outside. And there was the screams of the detainees who were being interrogated, or the interrogators that were screaming at them to break them. Now, just about 3 to 4 months ago, there's a film that was released. It was called Taxi to the Dark Side. And it won the Oscar. It won the Oscar because I'm in it. No. I am in it. It did win the Oscar, but not because I'm in it. It won the Oscar because it questioned America at its rawest. It put to it questions that America couldn't answer at the time, at the similar given time, that the Vietnam My Lai massacres and things like that have taken place. So it's still very raw with the Americans, and that's why it hasn't been as publicized as well as it should have been. But nonetheless, they saw fit, and rightly so, to give this film the Oscar. And the reason why it's called Taxi to the Dark Side is because it's about a taxi driver, an Afghan taxi driver who was in my cell. And he was in front of my cell the night that he died. But he didn't die of natural. The death certificate for his case says that he received blunt force strikes on his legs that caused his blood to clot and for him to die. His legs looked as if they had been pulverized or driven over by a truck, and these are the quotes from the death certificates, and that had he survived, he would have required his leg to be amputated. Now, the reason why this man died is because they had a process in Bagram, which was shock and awe. And this meant that whoever's brought into custody must first be dragged through the mud with a hood over their head, with their hands shackled behind their backs and their legs shackled, kicked and punched and spat at and screamed at, and dogs brought over so closely that you could feel the saliva of a snarling dog dripping onto your skin. And then a knife taken to your trousers and to your shirt or whatever you're wearing, and cut the clothing off so that you could feel the cold blade of the steel as it glided against your skin. And then taken in this manner, in naked, and being shaved so that if you were like the majority of people in Afghanistan, the men in Afghanistan who have beards and thin and hair, that if they were to look at themselves in the mirror, they would not know who they were. They wouldn't recognize themselves. And then to be taken in this manner and to be interrogated by the FBI, by the CIA, by military intelligence, with people standing with M16s, shotguns and handguns, around in the chamber, just in case, on your knees. And this was the manner in which we were brought into custody and held. And that was just the process of beginning, the initiation ceremony of how you now have become, as they said, the property of the United States of America, and you have no rights. And these are the terms used verbatim to us as detainees, that you have no rights, meaning you have no human rights because you are not human. And therefore you'll be treated accordingly. And part of that treatment meant that you would be dehumanized to the point that because you look different, because most of the people detained in Afghanistan in the war on terror are Muslims, and most of the Muslims come from either Asia or Africa, so therefore they would be darker skinned. They would speak either Swahili, Urdu, Arabic, Pashto, Farsi, Uyghur, Turkish. Very few of them would be speaking English. And therefore the process has already begun. We see that in this country. We see that in this country, how people can be dehumanized simply because they speak a different language and they look different, or they are different. So that process has already begun. Then on top of that, of course, the most powerful men, and arguably the most stupid men on earth, had already designated us and the detainees there as the worst of the worst. In fact, Clive Stafford Smith has written a book called Bad Men. And the reason why he's called it Bad Men is a compliment to President Bush, who said, I don't know what these folk have done, but I know they're bad men. And as a result of this, as a penny drops, it drops down and doesn't go up. It's the same in the US military. And as far as the system bill is concerned, when a statement is made, it drops down. And it drops down to the enlisted soldier, who then interprets what has been said at the top according to their reality. And then they administer that interpretation in tangible terms. And they administer it upon us, the aliens, which is what we've been described as. We've been described as enemy combatants and enemy aliens. I.e. people that are different, foreign, subhuman. And that's how, coming back to the story of this taxi driver who'd been picked up for no other reason other than that he drove past the place that had been attacked by an RPG, a rocket throw grenade that was an American base. And they managed to get the first person that was there. He was exonerated of having committed any wrong, but only after he was dead. And the story of what happened that night, that fateful night that I will never forget, is that he was taken to the front of the cell and put after his shock and awe capture to be broken down into the front of the cell area called the airlock, which is where a person is isolated before they are either brought into or taken out of the cell from the other prisoners. And he was tied like so, on his head. So tight, cutting into his skin, the shackles were on his wrists, that if you tried to relax, there's pain into your wrists, cutting more. So you have to try to get back up again. Hour passed, 2 hours passed, 4, 10, 12, 24, 48. He continued to be in this position, moaning, complaining. Sometimes they let him out just to go to the bathroom or to eat. But other than that, that was the position. And I too, like many other people, was put in that position. Not as long as he was, but nevertheless, that was part of the punishment that we received for just speaking to the person on the opposite or adjacent sides to us. Speaking was an infraction against the rules. If you speak, if you look like you're speaking, if you make a prayer and you whisper it, that is deemed to be attempting to speak to the person that's next to you. And if you've done that, you are now trying to communicate, because if you're communicating, therefore, you must be up to no good. So that's why I said to you, you could hear the footsteps. You could hear the screams, because everything else was silent. You were not allowed to speak. And so he remained in this position until I saw him from his tiptoes relax and his head drop. He was, of course, at that point where the pain no longer mattered. The pain didn't matter anymore.
Bring him on.
You are listening to Indie Media On Air on KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara. That was Mozan Beg, a former British detainee at Guantanamo Bay and founder of Cage Prisoners. For links to this and all the stories you'll hear on today's show, visit the Indie Media On Air program page at kpfk.org. We'll be back in a moment.
To all the troops I sent to